When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, Chris Evans here. Thank you for downloading this week's podcast of The Best of the Breakfast Show with Sky from Virgin Radio. Coming up, the funniest of funny men, Ramesh Ranganathan, elaborates on life lessons from his new book, As Good As It Gets. The mind-meddling Darren Brown tunes us into happiness with his latest book, A Little Happier. The Horn Section's Alex Horn tells us all about Season 10 and Season 1 of Taskmaster on Channel 4. And the punchy Piers Morgan explains why the world has gone nuts with his new book, Wake Up, The World's Gone Nuts. All of that and loads more still to come. Now, Dapper Dave, tell us, who is the first guest?
He's in a league of his own, runs his own Ranga Nation, and manages to put up with Rob Beckett. Is there anything he can't do? His new book, As Good As It Gets, Life Lessons from a Reluctant Adult, is out tomorrow, and here to dish out the advice is the always incredible Ramesh Ranganathan.
Morning, Rom.
Morning, Chris. How are you?
Very well. Thank you so much for coming in. We've all thoroughly enjoyed your book. It's hilarious. It's obviously a conversation with yourself more than anybody else.
Yeah.
We're saying, in the red corner, it's Ramesh Ranganathan, and in the blue corner, oh, it's also Ramesh Ranganathan. Okay, boys, go to it. I mean, that's what's gone on here, isn't it?
Yeah, basically, it's just sort of me kind of taking an in-depth look at myself, I guess. But I was slightly nervous because I wanted to be so... One of my things is that as I do more stand-up and as I do more writing and everything, I'm always trying to approach being as honest as possible. And so that was my starting point with this book. I wanted to be as honest as possible. But then comes the sort of worry that you've been too honest and you've presented yourself in too negative a light, really. I always have that ongoing concern.
Because you said you discovered this when you were reading the audiobook out loud.
Yeah.
It's one thing writing it,
yes,
and then editing it, then rewriting it, writing around it, and then reading it back to yourself in your head. But then as a former teacher, you would know this better than anybody else. You say it out loud. Oh, it sounds different, doesn't it, out loud, in court?
Yeah, I mean, that was exactly what happened. Because you do have this intense period. You've written it. I'm terrible at sort of going, I like the initial draft and then the redrafting and editing and stuff I hate, but you do all of that. And then you take a break from it a bit and then you come back to it to do the audiobook. And then as I was in the middle of the audiobook, I was like, oh, this has already gone to the printer, isn't it? I can't take this back, this stuff. So, yeah, it was the first moment where I thought, well, I have really revealed a lot of myself here. This is...
Well, it's funny because you said before you came on the end, you've just done it again now. Because you talked about it first of all. You said, oh my goodness me, I've been so truthful here. And then you said, I've revealed so much about myself.
Yeah.
So there's one thing, because you can be true about nothing. Yeah, but
that's
you can be
true.
Too revealing. So,
you're
are you
right.
worried about the fact you've revealed too much or you've been too truthful about what you've revealed?
Well, I think that, you know, when I think that I've been truthful about myself, which is a problem. you know when you have a lot of these thoughts and ideas and foibles and sort of you're self-conscious about various things and you keep that inside and you present a version of yourself, don't
yeah,
you? And
yeah,
so
yeah.
when I was writing the book, I sort of was very honest about my sort of my feelings about my shortcomings and my attitude towards parenting and how I feel about myself. And you say all of those things. And then you put that out and you think, wow, this is a really honest reflection of my genuine thoughts, and I'm not sure that's attractive. Not that I'm trying to be attractive, that ship has sailed for me, but, you know, just, I did worry about it. I continue to worry about it.
Well, let's keep saying the name of the book. It's called As Good As It Gets, and it's really, really funny. It's really funny, but also it's really intriguingly written, actually, Ramesh. It's out tomorrow, and I would encourage you to get it. It's a 9 out of 10 for me. It's not a 10, because that's, like, my best books ever. And
yeah,
it's,
sure,
you know,
sure.
And there's, like, you know, Eckhart Tolle's up there. And
yeah, I would support that. It's not one of the best books ever.
You know, no, Old Man and absolutely. The Sea, you know. And they're 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is a 9 out of 10.
Yeah. And the fact I'm even in the same conversation as those guys is
well, they,
is great.
You know, books are books, aren't they,
yeah.
I suppose. But, you know, what's at the end of every chapter, because, you know, very funny, you write in chapters under subject headings, but then at the end of every chapter, I noticed, this is so funny, right? So chapter titles are, for example, sex, friendship, flake, being a flake, which is really funny, the flake text that we all send to people. I don't send them anymore. That's, people say, why'd you get rid of the phone? That's probably the main reason, so I don't send any more flaky texts. Holidays, politeness, quality time, then I'll miss a few out, and then he goes, role model, look after your health, alcohol abuse, learning to cook, train a geek, music, get a tattoo. Really funny book, great to dip into, easy to read, but quietly profound, actually.
You think so?
I know so, right? Because I read a lot of these books. And you start off by talking about the fact that it's not a self-help book, but you allude to the fact that you do read self-development books and self-help books, and I do, and I make no apology for it. But here's what I thought, right? I think it's about chapter 6 or 7, right? And I don't know if you realise this, right?
No.
But I thought at the end of... which chapter would this one be? This will be Getting Old, right?
Okay.
So at the end of the Getting Old chapter, I'm reading it and loving it, right? And I'm loving the fact that all you 40-somethings are talking about getting old. And I'm 10 years older than you. I'm thinking, shut up! Right? And the reason I'm saying shut up is because people who are 65 are telling me to shut up.
Sure.
And people who are 75 are telling the 65-year-olds. Just everybody shut up about getting old.
Yeah.
You know, because anyway. But it makes for a good chapter. And then the prevailing thought that came to me at the end of this chapter is, oh, at the end of every chapter, you get a bit Jordan B. Peterson. You do.
That wasn't intentional. I don't know why that's happened.
Because his book is 12 Rules for Life.
Right.
Have you read it?
No, I've not read it.
It's absolutely awesome.
Right.
Whether you agree with him or not, it's just a very, very profound read.
Right.
And he starts off with the premise of a rule for life, and then he takes you on this journey through each chapter. Sometimes it's funny. It's always thought-provoking. And sometimes they're extreme. Sometimes you want to shout at him, you know, next time you see him. But then he gets back, the last chapter or two, gets back to this sort of calm, really tranquil lesson that he started with. And some of your chapters go way off piece. They're hilarious, like you say. You maybe have gone too far, which is great for the reader because no risk for us.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
And then, for example... here's the Jordan B. Peterson bit of the hilarious getting... And the getting older chapter is hilarious because it's one of the most paranoid. Romish says this at the end. That's obviously not really you hating the house. It doesn't matter what the... that's you being insecure about them having a nice house and comforting each other by pretending the house is awful. That's what we're doing when we slag people off. It's all a desperate attempt by us to forget how utterly... rubbish. We think we are, paraphrasing. It's a rank side of human nature. The people who don't have that in them and seem to be truly happy for other people's successes tend to be the happiest people generally. Don't get me wrong. They're also completely insufferable, paraphrasing, but they don't care. So be discreet and try not to be a fool, idiot, paraphrasing. And if you are a fool, idiot, paraphrasing, at least try to be discreet about it. So it's a really sort of calm, settling... Did you notice that about the chapters?
No, I didn't, actually.
Every chapter finishes like that.
Right. I didn't know that. That wasn't a deliberate thing.
It's great. It's like there's two Romishes having a rook, which is great.
Yeah.
And then there's the other, almost like the wiser, owlish Romish... who does the last couple of chapters to come a couple of paragraphs. Brilliant.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome.
For that insight.
All right, well done. That's the brilliant... How great is Romesh?
Yeah.
He's just great to have around. He's so cool. Romesh Ranganathan, As Good As It Gets, Life Lessons from a Reluctant Adult.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
He's made a career of meddling with your head, so who better to write a book about managing your mind? His new bite-sized handbook, A Little Happier, is out tomorrow, and here to tell us all about it is a brown that knows exactly how to turn a frown upside down.
Yeah!
It's Darren Brown!
Morning, Darren!
Hello! You've seen my front face. It's terrifying.
Yeah, what do you think about the Peppa Pig story?
I've never watched Peppa Pig, but I that's just brilliant. Peppa Pig's front face.
Peppa Pig is coming to get you.
I love it.
There is a theme park. Darren, if you went to the Peppa Pig theme park, you could be the only person ever, I'm guessing, that's been to the theme park but never watched the show.
Exactly. What madness.
Crazy. Right, this lovely little book, A Little Happier. Now, I'm guessing, and I'm usually wrong, but here's my guess anyway, that this was notes to yourself and you thought, hang on a minute, these could be useful to other people.
Well, it's actually a shorter version of a book called Happy that I wrote a few years ago, which is a popular book. It's quite a big book. It's quite a commitment. So it kind of made sense during anxious times to write a condensed version of the same book. So it's a slightly odd project in that sense. But it's partly new stuff and partly stuff from the old book.
Anxious times. Tell us about your anxiety, you know, over the last 6 months, because we talked recently, but you know, do you have your own take on anxious times now?
Well, it's been sort of all right for me, but I think even if you're having a relatively good time of it, lockdown's obviously a very different thing for different people, but it still creeps in, doesn't it? You know, you feel a bit misplaced, or your partner does. Everyone's relationship seems to be slightly, you know, odd, or being put to the test. It is an odd time. The book is largely about Stoicism, which is, I think, a very good way of it's all about minimizing unnecessary disturbance by only trying to control the things that you can control, which are your thoughts and your actions.
Now, we talked about this before because we talked about exactly what you're saying there. We actually said those words from your book out loud. And then I said, the word control is interesting there. So because there is another school of thought, isn't there, that, you know, just wanting to control anything, even the things you can, is perhaps the sort of first step up the wrong ladder.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's also a good point. There's actually two kind of opposing ideas, which I think are important and therefore weirdly compatible in a strange way, which run through the book. One is this Stoic idea, which is an undeniable recipe for minimizing anxiety. But then there's also and drawing your center of gravity in and becoming more robust, which I think is hugely helpful. But there's also the opposite of that, you know, which is a very un-Stoic idea, which is, you know, normally in life, the times where we do feel most anxious and where we feel isolated and like we're failing, or when, you know, when life is hard, which, you know, always happens at some point, you know, we're going to find ourselves there. That is precisely the time when we're actually most connected with other people. That is the time when we're kind of experiencing the actual weight of life. It's the thing that we all share. You know, we all have those moments. And I think this lockdown is a very literal demonstration of that. You know, here we are on the one hand, most isolated, and on the other hand, all sharing in the same thing. And that's, it's sort of the opposite of a Stoic approach, but it's at the same time, I think there's a, we can lean into that. You know, we can lean into a feeling of sharedness. I think that can really help too.
I love that. I was listening to a guy yesterday, billionaire at the age of 32, still successful now at the age of 44. He's company's always been private. He's thinking about taking it public. He was predicting who the first, he says the first trillionaire will be somebody who is involved in sustainable energy. That's his prediction. But he also talks about his inner madness, you know, and his seeking of happiness. And he says the most important thing as far as he's concerned is talking to people. Now, you talk about that in the book as well. Talking to people, talking to his wife, talking to his kids, even though they think he's a loser, but it doesn't matter as long as he says things out loud to them. And they, as long as he says things and they roll their eyes, at least he's still saying things out loud to his children, and they might be hearing what he's saying because they seem to be disagreeing with it, which is fine because at least it's landing. Then he has a couple of therapists. What is the top three things you think are important to a person's happiness that they can do on a daily basis?
Well, first of all, I think separate the things that are your task from other people's. So the things, your thoughts and your actions are on one side of the line. You're in control of those. Everything else, what other people do, what they think, how things turn out, is on the other side of the line. And the idea is just to roll with those things, just to sort of decide they're kind of fine. Because nothing bad happens if you do, if you just focus on the things that you are in control of and sort of just let the rest just kind of be. And it's a 2,000-year-old idea. And it's the opposite of what we're told nowadays, which is to set your goals and believe in yourself and you can kind of make the universe provide what you want. It's just simply unrealistic. So you can have high intention but low expectations. I think weirdly, a second one might be lowering your expectations.
Yeah.
You know, most of our frustrations come from having absurdly high expectations of what the world is going to provide. So all of that's about avoiding anxiety. But I think if that was two, the third one would be to allow anxiety to sit sometimes, to see that it has value. You don't move forward in life. You don't grow unless you recognize something that's wrong or makes you anxious and deal with that and move forward. You know, you have to deal with insecurity in order to grow.
That's really interesting. So sitting with anxiety, I've never heard that before, but I like it. So how long do we sit with it for? You know, because you don't let it fester. You don't let it, you know, those looping thoughts that send you crazy. So how does one sit with anxiety purposefully?
Well, I think an image that I've sort of had for a while with this is like an X equals Y diagonal along a graph, right? So your X axis is all your goals and your aims and the stuff that you want to get out of life. And then the other axis, which they used to call fate or fortune, is just life. It's stuff that life is throwing back at you, all the stuff that you can't control. And what we actually live is an X equals Y line, a kind of meandering line along that diagonal, because sometimes we're on top and sometimes life is on top. So I think the key is if you just sort of make your peace with that, if you allow for a certain amount of anxiety, because that's part of that meandering line. But if you can also balance that with bringing your center of gravity kind of inside. And as I said, there's certain separation between what you're in control of and what you're not.
Right, now I know you've got to go. A, because I was told anyway, you know, before the show, and then during the interview, you know, about 5 minutes left, 6 minutes left. But now I really know you've got to go because this show is sponsored by Sky, and we're watching Sky News at the moment, and it's just flashed under Kay Burley's nose that Darren Brown is coming up live at 9:30. So you better be off there, Darren.
Well, I better go. But thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
I'll pass on the best to Kay Burley.
All right, always, Darren Brown. A little happier. And sometimes all you need to be is a little happier.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Dapper Dave, over to you.
He's a musical, comedic and televisual genius that married very well indeed. The 10th series of The Brilliant Taskmaster starts tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on Channel 4. Greg Davies calls him Little Alex. Rachel calls him my hunky husband. But you can call him the awesome Alex Horn.
Yay!
Yay!
All right, Al.
Morning, it's Bring Your Partner to Work Day.
Yay! See, this is not fair, because Tash can't come into the building at the moment, nor can Carol, nor can our kids.
It's the only reason I do the job I do, is so I can spend some time with my wife.
Yes, because you predicted the pandemic, and
you
thought, I better get a TV show, so that when she's at work, I can go and see her.
You know, weirdly, we did predict the pandemic. The Horn Section did a song about the Spanish flu 4 years ago, and the last line was, and the next pandemic's due. And it was a funny line at the time.
Yeah.
And now it feels like...
awkward.
Oh, yeah, very awkward. We can't perform it. We thought we could perform it, but
can't.
No, we can't. We can't perform it.
Right, so let's talk about Taskmaster and the Horn Section and everything to do with you, because you're great. So Taskmaster, it hits the terrestrial airwaves. Now, people may not know what that is, but it's like one of the old-fashioned channels. So
yes.
Channel 4, one of the big channels. Channel 4 didn't exist when I was born. ITV did. I remember the first day of Channel 4. I remember that coming on the air. Countdown was the first programme.
That's right.
It's there now. Channel 5, remember that coming on the air?
Me too.
And do you remember the first people to be seen on Channel 5?
Oh, that's a great quiz question, and I don't know the answer to it.
The Spice Girls.
Was it?
Yeah, because they've been commissioned by Channel 5 to re-record 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
And there's five of
them. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah.
Well, there were.
Good point.
Yeah, there's still four.
But they are still all alive.
They are alive and apparently still friends.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
So we have Channel 4 still, and it's still doing great business, and you're on Channel 4 tomorrow at 9 p.m. Now, for everybody who doesn't know what Taskmaster is, tell us how it was born, how it was conceived. The first Taskmastery thing that ever happened on the planet.
So our son, my wife, Rachel Haunt, who's a newsreader, we had a baby 11 years
ago. She
still is. We had a baby, and so I couldn't go to the Edinburgh Festival, and instead I sat at home and thought of something to do. So I sent an email to 20 comedians and said, right, I'm going to do a thing called Taskmaster, where I'll send you a task every month, you've got to do it, and then in Edinburgh we'll see who won. So the very first task was deposit some money in my bank account, most money wins. That paid for the venture, and is still paying for it now. And so, yeah, that was it. It was just a laugh, you know, just 20 comedians being competitive, and that shrunk down to 10 people the next year, and then someone said, this could work on telly.
Yeah.
And it has, thank God.
And so the first telly show was with Dave. Was it with Dave?
Yeah, that was 4 years after the Edinburgh thing.
Right.
And Dave were the only people who trusted in the format, because it was quite, not brave, but it was quite different, because it's the same cast every single episode throughout the whole series, which is unusual in a panel show, and there's no script, it's all unplanned. So there were risks. But Romesh, for example, agreed to do the first series, and that set the ball rolling. It was Frank Skinner and Romesh and Roisin Conaty, and a good cast that meant other people trusted it.
So it's punching above its weight from a casting point of view, and I don't mean that as a slight at
all. Yeah, well, it was a house of cards, really. Greg agreed to do it if Frank agreed to do it, and Frank agreed to do it if Tim Key agreed to do it, and so on. If one of them had dropped out, the whole thing would have fallen flat.
And so you're like a Hollywood producer trying to get, I can guarantee this guy to be in it, you know, if the script's done over here, if we can guarantee a budget of so-and-so, then they'll all do it.
There's a lot of wheeling and dealing. I had to take people out to lunch, and I'm not very good at that sort of schmoozing.
Well, or are you?
Or am I?
You're like the no-makeup-makeup. You're the no-sell-sell. You're the no-deal-dealer.
Okay.
Well, you've done so many fantastic things. So, for example, you've taken a show that's been on Dave for 9 series, and it's gone to Channel 4. Nothing. The traffic doesn't flow that way. You look like some kind of alchemist.
Yeah, I do feel like a con artist.
Yeah.
Especially with most of the things I do, I surround myself with better, more talented people. So the Taskmaster thing, I'm not the host. I've got Greg in to host it. Get the other comedians to make it funny. And the Horn Section, the band thing, I'm not musical at all. So I've got these other musical people to make it work. This is a clever thing to do, Chris.
Well, therefore, you are clever by your own admission. It's
okay.
A clever thing to do. But what's interesting about when people, you get these people who suffer victim syndrome. So you get so you get schizophrenics and get paranoid schizophrenics. So paranoid schizophrenics is it's all my fault.
Right.
Schizophrenics are it's all everybody else's fault. And if you say to the victim kind of character, you know, what's gone wrong? What's gone wrong in your life? And they go, well, that went wrong, right? And then I had to go at this, and then this person let me down. And then I had to go at doing that, and that all let me down. And the easiest first question right back is, the most sobering, is what's the one thing all those things had in common? You were involved.
Oh, no.
Now, it's the opposite to you.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Phew.
So you say, well, I'm not really that. Yeah, but what have all these hits got in common? You're at the heart of them.
I'll tell you what, it does help having a comedian on the producing side of a comedy show. There's a lot of comedy TV that's made by career TV producers.
Yeah.
And having a comedy brain that the other comedians trust, because it's a very small little industry, the comedy industry. We've all grown up together. So people like Johnny Vegas is on the new one. The new series. We've all done gigs together in tiny little rooms, so we all trust each other, and that's really helped.
Trust is very important as well. I've met a lot of comedians in production that didn't know they were comedians.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't work so well.
No.
To be honest.
Yeah. Well, we've had 50 comedians now in the show because it's the 10th series, and we really... It's a real honour to get to know those people really well. Each one feels like a school year, and you graduate with them, and you do find out every little detail about their life, because they do the task and then they sit in a little room and they spill the beans. So I know some secrets.
Well, good luck to you, my friend.
Thanks, Chris.
Can't wait. 9 p.m. tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thanks again for letting me come on your show.
You're always welcome. And you can catch up on the first 9 now via all 4.
That's correct. All the episodes are there. That's hundreds there for you to enjoy. Oh, there is a kids version as well at 5:15 on E4 on Sunday afternoons. It's just bleeped. So it's not different, but it's not. There's no
good.
Swearing.
I've been saying that for ages about Who Dares Wins, the SAS show. They should do a non-potty mouth version of it. And people have been saying that about my podcast. So what am I? I haven't learned anything. Right, gotta go. Ta-da, everyone. Well done. Good luck.
Thanks, Chris.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We've heard, you've heard, we've all heard from 3 top-notch guests already, but there's still so much more to come. Comedy colossus David Baddiel tells us about his new kids' book, Future Friends, Super Cool Sue Perkins chats her directorial debut in the new series of Urban Myths for Sky Arts. Hollywood superstar Julia Stiles discusses returning to Riviera for Series 3 on Sky Atlantic. And astronaut Tim Peake gets the stars aligning in his new autobiography, Limitless. All of that and more still to come. Dapper Dave, over to you for the big intro.
According to him, being woke is a joke and we need a decent lashing of liberalism. His new book, Wake Up, Why the World Has Gone Nuts, is out today. So without further ado, batten down the hatches. Snowflakes beware, it's the masterful media marmite, Piers Morgan.
Good morning, Piers.
Good morning, chaps. Lovely to see you.
Nice to see you. I've been promising the listeners that I'm going to try and get the nice Piers, the lovable Piers, the funny Piers, the charming Piers, the Piers that I know and love. How do you feel about that?
Who is that guy? I'd love to do that because there's so much serious stuff that's been raging all year, and I've been finding myself getting so angry about stuff connected to the pandemic and to world leaders and Trump and Boris and all this. It would actually be quite nice to talk about stuff.
Okay.
We can slightly uplift people.
Because I've encouraged people to buy your book, even if they don't like you, you know, because it's really important to listen and to read and to watch things from people who you don't agree with, because there's not enough of that going on nowadays. And I've said to people, you know, even if you don't want to give Piers Morgan any money or anybody to do with him, i.e. his publishers, go to a bookshop and read the intro to this book. The intro to this book is better than most books, and I'm not blowing smoke up, but it's really good. And also the first 2 pages of the intro are like an intro to the intro, which is about the world going nuts. So many questions, Piers. Here we go. The world's always been nuts. You sound like you're surprised by this, but it's been like that for tens of thousands of years.
It has. What has concerned me about the way liberalism has gone, I identify as a liberal. You know, I've edited the Daily Mirror for 10 years. My instinctive gut feel to stuff is liberal. And what's really struck me is, of course, that on the right, the liberals scream about the right wingers and say they're all intransigent, self-righteous, they think they know best and so on. So I wasn't going to target them because that's a familiar battleground and that's been raging now on social media for years. What's more interesting to me is what's happened to liberals, and especially this woke element of the liberal crowd. And it's become, in my view, really weird and insidious and antithetical to liberalism. And I explain in the book, in that intro, the history of liberalism and what it really should be about. It should be about fairness and tolerance, a desire to have democratic debate, a desire to be able to sit opposite somebody, hear a view you completely disagree with, maybe even find offensive, but actually tolerate somebody's right to have a different opinion, and maybe engage in a debate where you both learn something, and at the end of it, reach points of consensus, agree to disagree about other stuff, and go down the pub and have a pint. That's gone.
Country. It's gone completely. I mean, lots of people say you add fuel to that fire.
I say it myself about myself in the book. There's no question when you've got, you know, I've got 7.6 million Twitter followers, not that I'm counting, obviously, it's not about size, although it is actually about size. But when you've got that sort of platform, and to put it in perspective, when I left The Mirror in 2004, they had about 2.5 million readers. So it's a gigantic platform. And sometimes you can forget that and you can pile in on these culture war stuff. And before you know it, you're fueling the fire. And I've definitely done that. It's really a clarion call to all liberals, including myself, to say, can't we just now just reset? The pandemic surely will reset many, many things for many people in different ways. And I think liberals, and especially woke liberals, have got to ask themselves whether cancel culture, which is their preferred mechanism for shouting people down, is to cancel them, ruin their lives, end their jobs and so on. Is that liberal? Is that actually what liberalism is?
Let's talk about COVID a bit, right? So newest theory I've heard as of yesterday is that, and it's only a theory, it's only a school of thought, and nobody's saying it's right or wrong, is that if you look at pandemics historically, back to the Spanish flu and the ones in between, they all last about 18 months. Yeah. And this was just always going to last about 18 months. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a merit to that. I mean, the difference between this situation and the last big pandemic in 1918 was that then people weren't flying around so much and transmitting it from country to country. But there's a logic to thinking that within 2 years maximum, this blows itself out. I mean, I think what's really important is that we all now basically admit we don't know anything. Everyone's turned into an expert epidemiologist. Even the epidemiologists who are experts don't agree with each other.
Yeah.
So the idea that anyone can say with absolute certainty this course of events is the right one, this is wrong. What you can do, you can hold a government to scrutiny over every single decision, and you can compare uniquely in this case all around the world, and you can see other countries and see how they've handled it, and you can compare. And by that comparison, as I keep telling people, look, you can spin it any way you like, but we have the worst death toll in Europe, and we have the worst economic meltdown in Europe. These are two undeniable facts. You don't have to be on the left or right tribe to be able to agree we've had a massively bad pandemic so far. And as we make decisions now, which are huge decisions, another lockdown, do we do it regionally, nationally, whatever, we are trusting the same group of people. And that's what concerns me about this. I think trust in this government and in Boris Johnson and in Matt Hancock and others is at an all-time low. And that concerns me about the public's willingness to actually listen to anything they say they've got to do.
But so I was listening to something yesterday about science and about the fact that, you know, scientists never deal in fact because they think the scariest F word in the English language to a scientist is fact. Mm. Because they don't prove facts, they try and eliminate doubt. The best they can ever do is make something as least doubtful as it can possibly be. So that's why it's all confusing in the first place.
We had a brilliant scientist on yesterday. He's one of the top oncologists in the country. He's actually saved a member of my family's life in the last year in a miraculous way, from stage 4 cancer to saving his life. So I know how good he is. And he argued blindly against any form of lockdown and gave a very compelling set of reasons why. Then we had two other scientists with him who are equally eminent in their fields, arguing that everything he just said was completely wrong. So the idea that people on Twitter know more than any of these people is obviously ridiculous. And yet every day I get these, you know, amateur epidemiologists informing me of their latest theory. The truth is, I think we just have to accept things are going to be rough. And as you said at the start of this little bit of chat, probably for a total of 18 months to 2 years. And then one of a variety of things may happen. We may get a vaccine. although we never got one for HIV and we've never had one for any coronavirus. But the signs are that because of the concerted global effort to get one, we may get lucky and have one. Or more likely, I think, that may come first is we get drugs that stop people dying, as we did with HIV. And again, because every scientist in the world is trying to crack the same thing, we're already seeing drugs now having a material effect on stopping a lot of people from dying. That seems to me a more likely scenario.
The book is called Wake Up by Piers Morgan. He starts his book by talking about how he's a liberal, not to wind you up, because he is. And I hope that came across in our conversation just now. Just my last question before you go. How many people do you get on GMB thinking, I have more things to say about this than my guest? Because I've just got to tell you, it was the opposite for me over the last 45 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you and I meet a lot of interesting people. I think we have two of the most privileged jobs imaginable, because you can meet anyone from eminent scientists to, you know, soap stars to whatever, and they always surprise you. And people are interesting. You know, we're all unique in our own little way. People are fascinating. I'm fascinated. Really, what drives me is a fascination with people. And I think you're the same.
Good. I can't wait for the next chapter of the Piers Morgan story. I won't be watching on Monday, but and hopefully, and this is what we said, because I said, there's another side to Piers and I want to get it across. And I said it on the radio between 7 and 8. And then I said, but I don't want him to come across too nice and too likeable, because you're going to watch his blimmin' show instead of listening to ours. Because a lot of people said, well, we used to watch him, but we can't stand him anymore, so now we'll just do you instead. I could have pushed him back in your direction, Piers Morgan. Actually, he's horrible. This is all an act.
You know what? I prefer that last line, because the rest of it's quite brand damaging.
Yeah, sorry. Can only apologise. I'll see you in court. Thank you, Piers.
Thanks, Chris.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
His new book sees a time traveller visit from a future where climate change and viruses from mutant animals mean no one can leave their house, which is, of course, ridiculous. Future Friend is out now, and here to leaf through its pages is the mighty mind of the brilliant David Baddiel.
Yeah, fortune teller.
Hello.
The prophetic David Baddiel. How did that happen then?
Well, I'm not that much of a fortune teller, because last time I was on this show, which I think while I was writing this book, I was announcing new gigs. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
I came on this show. You made fun of me for the temerity of saying, I'm going to add gigs to my tour, because people are definitely going to be going to the theatre. And you were quite right. Those gigs never took place. But nonetheless, this book, Future Friend, right, I was writing it in January, and I don't claim to be Nostradamus, but nonetheless, before anyone had heard of Hans Face Space and all that, I predicted a future where things are really bad, no one can go out, there's diseases everywhere, climate change is really bad, whatever. Trouble with that was, that's in 3020 in the book. And what I wanted was for my heroine, Pip, to come back from that time. She accidentally steps into a transporter that she thinks is going to take her to somewhere else in the city. It takes her to 2020, or it did in January. Then I thought, what I wanted to do is go out, have a fantastic time, meet lots of people, go to parties and that. Yeah. She can't do that. So, do you know how I fixed it?
Come on.
Take her back to 2019.
Good.
Yeah.
Genius.
It's a simple fix.
So the dystopian unwelcome, you know, disaster-ridden hinterland is not a new literary idea, is it?
No.
I mean, that's not at all.
It's not.
And did you go all the way to 3020 just to hedge your bets, because you thought it might have happened by then?
No, I think it just sounds like 1,000 years. Yeah. That's part of the thing. It's a kid's book. You want to paint things quite large.
Yeah.
So I thought 1,000 years in the future.
Yeah.
It's now 1,001 years in the future. I think that's okay because of 1,001 nights, you know, the whatever it is.
Yeah, 101 Dalmatians.
101 Dalmatians. Yeah, there's something about and
the binary table.
Exactly, it works quite well. Yeah, it's fine. But yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, even though, as you say, the dystopian future universe is not a new idea, I remember actually writing, what about mutant viruses? And I think I even say in it that some of them have come from animals that have evolved in weird ways.
They've all come from that, haven't they?
No, in the book, though.
No, but they've all, haven't they all done that anyway?
But all viruses?
Yeah, all pandemics have come from
animals.
Humans trying to domesticate animals in one form.
Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Well, again, not that new then in the book is what you're saying, but still.
I'm trying to take politely.
Yeah. No, but still, as I was writing it and as things started to crash in, I did think, well, what I was planning here was for this to happen in 1,000 years, not next month.
Yeah.
So that was really weird.
It's so unfair on you, because we were brought up with TV shows and movies like Space 1999, which were going to fall within our lifetime, but then seemed so far in the future, you think, oh, this is going to happen. And of course, they didn't. You know, Space Odyssey, 2001 Space Odyssey, same kind of thing. You think, well, hang on a minute.
No, they were always, I mean, when I was a kid, which was the same time as when you were a kid, 2000 seem like, well, that's the future. That it's going to be hoverboards.
Well, Wednesday was quite the future, wasn't it?
Yeah. But just the fact there was going to be a change in the numbers,
yeah.
I think, from 90 to 2,
yeah.
that made us think, like, well, obviously that's going to be hoverboards, that's going to be time travel,
yeah.
it's going to be... And then it wasn't. 2000, as I remember, was mainly the Millennium Dome.
Well, what about... But this is because we were misled and brainwashed by the blimmin' BBC.
Tomorrow's World.
Correct. It wasn't even next week. It was tomorrow. This is going to be tomorrow's world. So Thursday night, you go to bed, you think, well, can't wait for Friday.
Yeah.
We just watched this programme. All this stuff's going to be available.
Although, to be fair, if you actually go back and watch Tomorrow's World,
yeah.
it's mainly a bloke called William Woolard in a beige suit
yeah.
saying, look at this. And it's like a very big synthesizer or like a reel-to-reel tape recorder.
Yeah.
And you think, like, well, that isn't what happened, is
yeah,
it?
But also, the irony of going back to watch Tomorrow's World.
Yeah.
I just love that as a concept.
And what a concept. That is an amazing concept.
So your daughter is reading... She's six.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, we give her books to read, you know, kids' books to read. You know, and they're fine, like the Oliver Jeffers book. Oliver Jeffers is a genius. Of course
yeah.
he is. He was on the show last week. I love him to death. I'll always worship at his kids' book altar. And we have all his books. And we're now still reading our favourite books that we've been reading for the last 10 years to all our kids, to our littlest, to the twins, Boo and Walt, Ping and Pong, who are two, which is fine for Mary. But David, David's book is not a picture book.
Mm.
It's a proper book. It's a big, thick book. It's thicker than most books that you can find on the planet.
Members of the production team who are not parents.
Yeah.
But she's our resident kids book reviewer because she still sounds
very tired.
Cute.
Oh.
So yeah. once she stops sounding cute, well, you know, she'll lose the job. But currently, when she's had a little story at bedtime, and then I surreptitiously turn on the iPhone, I say, "What did you think of that, Mary?" She sounds really cute. So it's put a play
sounds
on the
lovely,
air.
Yeah.
And I was worried a little bit, and I said, well, I'll give it a go, but a six-year-old girl is not target market for this book. It's for, I would say, eight.
You know, I don't want to impugn your six-year-old. I'm sure she's very bright. But I do have some six-year-old readers who come up to me. They tend to be very proud.
Oh, so he doesn't want to stymie sales.
Having said
six-year-olds
that,
sometimes come up to me and say, you know, my older brother loves you, blah, 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 and I can read you. And,
yeah.
and they're very proud of that.
Well, she needed me to read it to her,
right?
But she really loved it.
I'm not sure.
Hang on,
she did.
Chris spoke over that really important bit.
Sorry.
Can you just say that again?
I'm not sure she.
We read it. Read it last night. We started with it. She loved the idea.
Yeah.
And this doesn't come through on her review at all. She loved the idea that you could program what your dreams were.
How far have you got in the book with Mary?
That chapter.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a review of the first chapter.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Is that okay with you?
I'm okay with that, yeah.
All right, okay. Here we go. So this is a first-hand box-fresh review of the first chapter of David Baddiel's brand-new book, Future Friend, which is out now in hardback, ebook, and indeed audiobook at most good booksellers. In fact, if they haven't got it, they're not a good bookseller,
yeah.
to be honest.
It's a chapter book, grown up. It's really, really imaginative, and I really want to go on the long slide from the clouds.
Come on, how cute is that, Dave?
That's unbelievable.
You need to take her with you wherever you go.
That's so fantastic. I love Mary. She's great.
So, well, she loves you.
I want her to read, you to read to her the rest of the book and fax me. Fax me, I've said. Review. I don't know why I said
tomorrow's
fax.
World, that's what it is.
That's what it is. And also, I've gone back in time. Right?
David Baddiel, Future Friend, is very, very good.
It is.
It's excellent.
Mary says so.
It's Mary says so. Everybody buy it. It's wonderful. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas to you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you very much.
Come on.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
A brilliant writer, performer and presenter, our next guest can now add director to that impressive list. Urban Myths, Joan Rivers and Barbara Streisand is on free to air Sky Arts tomorrow night at 10 p.m. And here to tell us how it all came together is a lady that's gotten Martin Scorsese quaking in his boots. It's the super Sue Perkins.
Morning, Soupy.
Hello.
So Joan Rivers and Barbara Streisand tomorrow at 10 p.m. Sky Arts. Sky Arts is now free to air, everyone. Well done, everyone.
Yes.
Sky. What a great decision. Sky Arts, it's not cheap to make, by the way. You know, it takes about 50 million quid a year to make this channel work. And they're giving it to us all for free now. It's on Freeview Channel 11 and Freesat Channel 147. And tomorrow night, gracing its screen, Joan Rivers and Barbara Streisand, one of the Urban Myth series from 10 p.m. Have you seen any of the others, Sue?
Yes. Really loved Steve Pemberton's last week about the young Les Dawson in Paris. And watched quite a few from previous series. There's a very good one about Bowie and Mark Bolan meeting in their manager's office to redecorate it. If you've seen that one, it's really sweet. These two legends, but before, obviously, they hit the big time. Communing.
I haven't seen that one. Now I want to watch it. Why is it so good?
Because they just sort of completely fall for one another. They're just sort of, they're completely different guys, different musical tastes and stuff, but they're just rollering this dude's wall and then realise they've got more in common. And I think that Bolan went on to be Bowie's son's godfather, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, they had a sort of lifelong sort of friendship after that meeting, is so it goes. So it's really lovely.
If it happened or if it didn't happen, and that's the thing, isn't it? I told the one about Bob Dylan and Dave Stewart and the plumber earlier on.
Yes.
And we'll get on to yours in a second or two. So is there a list of them? Do Sky Arts have them, or do you have to know one to then pitch to Sky and you get to direct it, maybe like you did with yours, or what?
Yeah, exactly that. So they get pitched from all kinds of different independent companies. So, you know, there'll be people who have heard, you know, this sort of rumour about X, Y and Z. And what Sky do when they're commissioning, I suppose, is curate and make sure that they've got a good broad sweep of stuff. And also the legals on it, because you don't think that's completely obviously outlandish, where people are still alive and going, hang on a second, that didn't happen. I didn't just have sale naked down, you know, Trump Tower or whatever. So, I think they as the sort of overseers make sure that there's a good sort of selection within the series.
Right. Well, as far as the you know, actionable, because they're not dead yet, thing is concerned, you're sort of 50-50, because one of yours is and one of yours isn't. So tell us about yours all round.
So, our urban myth comes from the mouth of Joan Rivers, who's sadly no longer with us. But in her autobiography, we can not necessarily trust Joan Rivers, because she did like to embroider her own life. But she said that in the late 50s, she decided to give serious acting a go. And there was only one part left off Broadway, which was for Man in Black, which she demanded to play. So they sort of gender swapped it, and she ended up playing in a love scene opposite a very young Barbra Streisand. Barbra Streisand has said nothing about this. They were in the same play, we know that, but there's no mention of a man in black or a gender swap or them kissing or anything like that. So I think it was fantastical. And Joan Rivers said it was fun kissing Barbra Streisand once you'd got her nose out the way, which is charming.
She is so funny. The more you read about Joan Rivers, the more you admire her. She was so brave, so brave as a comedian, wasn't she?
Yeah, she used to get bottled off stage. I mean, she'd go to these sort of strip joints and, you know, and just stand there and just be roundly abused. And I sort of didn't have very much to go on, really, when I started writing it. And I just wanted to inhabit her voice, because I grew up hearing her wisecracking. And it was just a gift to be able to write jokes for her, actually, albeit posthumously. And, she had a terrible time. But the nerve, you know, she never quit. Kept on going. She was, I think, bankrupt at sort of 55, and then by 60 was America's richest woman.
I know.
Something like that.
She's got an amazing story. I always get I don't know why, I don't actually, but you know, when I think about them, I always get her and Elaine Stritch not mixed up, but I want them sort of to be long lost twins, you know, sisters from a different mister.
You're right. Elaine Stritch is also fabulous. And no fear, but I think underneath that there was all kinds of neurosis, particularly with Joan. You know, she her parents were never really very pro her going on the stage. They were always slightly embarrassed. So I got a hint of that in this as well. It wasn't the thing, really, in the late 50s for women to be standing up and, you know, talking about relationships and marriage and sex and disappointment. And
well,
all
also, not then, you know, giving a lady, you know, a smacker if you're of the same sex, you know, in front of actual people.
That's bannable. That's why I think it's very unlikely. I know. But very unlikely it happened, because they'd have shut the theatre down pretty much.
But if we ever get to interview Barbra Streisand, never say never, could happen, haven't so far. I would just ask her straight. I'd just ask her. I mean, what would happen, and this isn't unfair on Barbra Streisand, but I'm imagining, is that, you know, if you get the chance to interview Barbra Streisand, you get a thicker than any phone book in history list of things you can't talk to her about, and this is probably on all of the pages, I would imagine, this particular myth. But then I'd just sign that, and then I would ask her the question straight off, then get thrown out of the building, probably from the top floor, because you'd have to go to her, she wouldn't come to you. But at least we'd know.
I heard a really nice story about her yesterday.
Go on.
which was that she was being interviewed, and the interviewer had got a real sweat on, because obviously he was panicking because he's in front of Barbara Streisand. And she leant over, took out a tissue from her pocket,
yeah,
and dabbed his top left lip and said, "We've both got to look after each other."
Don't believe it for a
second.
Don't believe it for a second.
I hope you heard something else. I mean, I'd be so terrified. I'd have such a dry mouth. Yeah. I'd be sort of clacking instead of speaking.
I think she leaned over. I think she leaned over and she got her tissue out and she whispered in their ear, "People usually sweat a lot more than this."
Yeah. You wouldn't. You wouldn't even. There'd be no sweating from you if you interviewed her.
I'd have a go, I suppose. We think you're awesome, Sue. Honestly, we do. Sue Perkins.
Written, mate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're welcome. Sue Perkins has directed and has written this Urban Myths latest instalment. Joan Rivers and Barbara Streisand. Did it or did it not happen? Or did some of it happen and some of it not happen? Did the last bit happen or not? Did all of it happen apart from the last bit? Tune in tomorrow to find out what you think. Yeah, find out what you think by tuning in tomorrow, 10 p.m. Yes, I like that. Sky Arts, Freeview Channel 11 and Freesat Channel 147 or Sky Arts from the usual platform.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
If you like your dramas with a healthy dose of corruption, conspiracy and class, then look no further. Series 3 of the sensational Sky original Riviera starts Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Sky Atlantic. And here to tell us more is an actress who sizzles on screen and everywhere in between. It's the stunning Julia Stiles.
Good morning, Julia.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Chris. Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. It's not the morning for me.
I know.
But
I
good
know.
Morning. Good morning to you.
You're in almost
and all the listeners.
The most north of North America, because you're in Canada, aren't you, at the moment?
I am in Canada. Yeah.
Wow. What's going down there?
Less of the coronavirus is what's going on.
So how? Because you talk about. By the way, happy third wedding anniversary. Congratulations on all that and everything else as well.
Thank you so much.
So you described it on your Instagram as 5 countries, 2 quarantines. How's your coronavirus journey been?
We are so nomadic that it's exactly that. We've been traveling so much and then landed in Vancouver, Canada, because my husband's Canadian and seemed like a safer place to land when everything went down in North America. But we're finally landed.
Okay. And you also have a rare breed of a thing at the moment called the brand new season of your TV show, because you made it before lockdown.
We did. We finished just in the nick of time. We were in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, and we finished season 3 of Riviera just before all the lockdown happened. And we're lucky, because otherwise we would have, I don't know what we would have done.
And also, you ended up in Argentina, but South America. But we're looking at Venice, and we're looking at Saint-Tropez. Tough job, Julia, but somebody's got to do it.
I love it. Thank you. I'm happy to take on that. I'm happy to take on that burden. This season, we started in Venice, and then we were in Saint-Tropez and Nice in the south of France. And then we spent a lot of time in Argentina. There's a whole part of the storyline that we go from Venice to Saint-Tropez and then realize that the conspiracy is even broader and it takes us to South America.
Yeah, I'm still with you in Venice and Saint-Tropez. And now, we were there as a family a couple of weeks ago, because we can still go to Italy. We can still go to Venice here from Great Britain. It was beautiful, because we had it to ourselves, which is not at all good for Venice and the businesses there. And I feel very sorry for them. But it was still quite busy when you were there. Now, filming in Venice, I've seen it in the Bond films. I've seen it in a few other films. How does one film in Venice? How does one make that happen? How is that okay?
It's a lot of logistics. Where you have to put all the equipment on boats. And it's amazing for the actors, because we go to work by taking a water taxi and we come home by boat. I think for the crew, loading up water taxis full of equipment is challenging.
Yeah.
But the Venetians were... We mostly filmed at night, and Venice is completely quiet and serene at night. But mm-hmm. I think we had to be really respectful of not waking anybody up, because Venetians are kind of over it. They're like, our city is beautiful. Get out of here.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, it might be the most beautiful city in the world. What's your take on that?
Absolutely. I mean, and I've been really spoiled with Riviera, being able to film in such beautiful parts of the world, but Venice is up on top, because it's an antique city on water. I mean, what's better than that?
It's so extraordinary, isn't it? It's such an extraordinary place. It's just an extraordinary thought that they thought to do that. Have you been to the Lido?
Yes, because we when we started filming season 3, it was the it was August, so it was the end of the summer season, and we did spend a weekend in Lido, and it feels very special.
All right, so you have some new friends in season three. Tell us about your Sherlock friend, Rupert Graves. What does he get up to?
Oh, Rupert is a new addition to Riviera. So basically, the beginning of season three, for people who have watched the previous seasons, Georgina is ready to be done with her past. She's distancing herself from the Cleos family. She has taken on her maiden name again, and time has passed, and she wants nothing to do with her history and the legacy of that family. But in walks, she's teaching at the Courtauld Institute in London, and in walks Rupert Graves' character, Gabriel, and offers her a more exciting job and says, basically, those who can't do, teach. And so he says, come with me to Venice, and we're going to track down a stolen Picasso and recover it. And she can't help but resist the adventure, so they go off to Venice, and he takes her on a journey there that then will get them wrapped up in a conspiracy that is deeper and more tangled than they had ever imagined, which then brings them to Argentina and Buenos Aires. But Rupert Graves is her sidekick. He's her, not even a sidekick, but just somebody that gets her to, he's the only person that's able to crack the shell, the veneer, and he's someone she can confide in. They have mutual respect for each other, and it's another side of Georgina that you haven't seen.
Good. So she lightens up a little bit in this one.
She lightens up, but only with him.
Okay. What about fingers crossed for season four of Riviera? How are you feeling about that?
Well, we're talking about it. I know that there's a possibility of it. Sky, I'm sure, wants to wait and see how season three does, but there's definitely a possibility. And also, the biggest question is, how are we going to do a show that's so international and involves so much travel, given the current, pandemic? But maybe a year from now, we could probably make a season four.
All right. Awesome, Julia. Thank you so much for staying up in Canada, in Vancouver, to talk to us. And season three, episode one, Sky Atlantic's Riviera, Thursday, 9 p.m. All episodes on demand via your Sky Q from Thursday.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Here comes another absolute 5 stars out of 5 book and author. Dapper Dave, over to you.
Most little boys dream of being an astronaut. Thankfully, our next guest never stopped dreaming. His autobiography, Limitless, is out now and tells his quite literally out-of-this-world story. Ladies and gentlemen, prepare for takeoff as we go astronaut to 60. It's the totally tremendous Tim Peake!
Astronaut to 60, Dave, one of your finest!
Fantastic.
Morning, Tim.
Good morning, Chris.
And Tim is with us in the studio. We've got an astronaut in the studio.
Yeah.
And we're on the 17th floor. It's not quite space, but it's on the way, isn't it, Tim?
It's high enough, yeah.
It's as high as we can make it. And our building is next to another one that looks a bit like a rocket, the Shard. Of course it does. Tim, this is not a How to Become an Astronaut book, is it? Because it's a winding and wending tale.
It is.
It's how you became an astronaut.
It's how I became an astronaut, yeah, which is perhaps not the easiest or the right way of doing things. It's a roundabout way of becoming an astronaut.
It's so brilliant. Now, you've read other astronauts' books, so tell us how theirs differ to yours or how yours differs to that.
Well, for starters, not many astronauts leave school at 18 with a C, D and an E at A levels. So it wasn't the greatest academic start. I joined the army, learned how to fly helicopters and kind of built myself up from there. I think I've never worked harder since leaving school, but I didn't work particularly hard in those last few years at school.
But you see, you are dead clever because you're an astronaut. You have to be really, really clever to be an astronaut. So school just wasn't for you, was it?
I think I just needed that focus. And for me, it was aircraft. And as soon as I had something to focus on, then I was able to direct all my passion towards that, and the academics then came because I needed it in order to learn how to become a test pilot at the end of the day.
Do you have a hero astronaut yourself?
Bruce McCandless.
Tell us about him.
Well, Bruce McCandless, NASA astronaut, he did the first untethered spacewalk from the back of the space shuttle bay, untethered. So big jetpack on his back, out he went into the blackness of space with no tethers, nothing.
No!
And he went a long way. It wasn't like he was just, a couple of meters from the handrails. He was out there.
Oh my God.
Think, wow, there's an amazing photograph of it. But the exposure he must have felt. And if something had gone wrong with that jetpack, if one of the thrusters had stuck on, for example, he's off, he's out into the universe, never coming back.
Have you met him?
I haven't, no.
Is he still around?
No, unfortunately. But,
how many astronauts have there been?
Oh, blimey. So we've had about 562, I think, up in space, something like that. It increases all the time. We had a couple of launches recently, so we might be more than that. But yeah, we've had about 560-odd people go into space.
All right, now, I've got to keep saying this. Tim is on to talk about his new book. Seriously, it's a fantastic book. Soldier Pilot, Parent Astronaut, Tim Peake, Limitless. I haven't read any other astronauts' biographies, autobiographies, so I wouldn't know in comparison, but I just love yours. Would you recommend one in particular?
Neil Armstrong's book is brilliant. Yuri Gagarin's Road to the Stars is a lovely book as well.
Have you got all these at home?
I've got them, yeah.
And now
yeah,
you've
yeah.
got yours to go with them.
I know, it goes on the shelf. It seems so really cool. Weird because, you know, these are people I grew up, you know, admiring and worshipping, and now I think I've got a book up there along with them.
Oh my God, I'm so pleased for you. It's so cool. All right, so let's talk about you learning to fly, because that's sort of how it all began.
It did, yeah. I started learning to fly as a cadet, and I remember getting into a glider for the first time and just thinking,
How old were you?
I think I was about 14.
Yeah, because you can do it really young, can't you?
Yes, with the cadets. And I was just so delighted that I liked it and enjoyed it, because I'd been passionate about aircraft. I'd gone to air shows and I'd built radio control planes and I was all about flying, but I'd never flown in one. And I was thinking, if I don't like this, then that's a disaster, because I'd set my heart on becoming a pilot, but absolutely loved it, and no turning back from there.
When did you get your licence for flying? How old were you?
I was 17.
Right.
I got a Royal Air Force flying scholarship. So it was brilliant. They give you 30 hours of flying, sponsored by the Air Force, in these small Cessna fixed-wing aircraft. I couldn't believe it. You know, I was up there flying before I could drive.
I've never been gliding.
Brilliant.
It's amazing. My wife bought me a gliding lesson for a present once, and we just never went and did it. What an idiot.
Yeah. No, it's wonderful. Just the silence. Some people go gliding with these altimeters that are noisy. They give you an indication of whether you're rising or falling, but you need to switch it off and just have the absolute pure silence in a glider enjoy it.
Getting up in the air, you know, but properly, not on a commercial airline, is a lot easier and accessible, more accessible than people might think, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, nowadays, I mean, it's much, much easier to get flying as well. So, you know, this year I've managed to get back up in helicopters again. So I'm delighted I'm back
flying. How were you? Does it come back? So you're riding
your bike?
It came
back straight. It's just like riding your bike. It came back straight away one morning, and that was me all checked out, ready to go.
I haven't flown a helicopter for ages. I mean, do you have to, because you haven't kept your hours up within a helicopter, so do you have to go all the way again?
No, it was just a bit of ground school, quick refresher flight, exam.
And you are an astronaut.
So.
I mean, you know, I think one space hour counts for about 1,000 normal hours, doesn't it? I would imagine. You're hoping to go up to space again, aren't you?
I'd love to go up to space again. Yeah, some of my classmates have already had their second mission. Luca and Alex and Thomas from France goes next year back to the space station. So we're all starting to have our second missions now.
And is yours guaranteed?
It's not guaranteed, but it's looking very likely between now and 2024.
Tim, what would you like people to take from this book?
I would like people to take that, you know, sometimes your route to where you want to go to doesn't have to be all planned out. It can be an incremental journey, and I've just enjoyed the journey. You know, I wasn't thinking about the destination as a young lad, as a teenager, as a boy as a man in my 20s. I was just enjoying the journey, and I got there. I didn't have good A-levels. I went back to school at 33. I got a degree. I worked really hard. You can always turn your life around. You can always achieve what you want to do. It's never too late.
Anything you want to say before you go? Anything else?
I've loved talking to you guys. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You are awesome, and you're welcome back anytime. That is Tim Peake, astronaut. His book is amazing. It's amazing. Tim Peake, Limitless, Soldier, Pilot, Parent, Astronaut. Boom.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Thank you so much for listening to this, the podcast of the Virgin Radio Breakfast Show. Don't forget, you can subscribe and get it every week from wherever you get your podcast, and you will never miss the weekly roundup of all the best bits from our Virgin Radio Breakfast Show with Sky.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.